The big thing in 1993 was absolutely NAFTA. When we're talking about global economics, NAFTA was not only a major thing for Mexico, the United States, and Canada, but it was precisely recognized by the entire world as the type of model of free trade agreement that was going to be expanded. If it answered capitalist needs the way the capitalist elites were pretty sure that it was, then there was no reason to believe that they weren't going to expand it beyond. Okay? But looking at Mexico, the U.S., and Canada, the three nations most affected by NAFTA, the three parts to that agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the impact was on its own enormous enough, and we didn't have to just recognize that this was going to become a global thing in order to realize that we needed to stop it. At the same time, there were various other types of institutions. The IMF and the World Bank were certainly around and alive and well then. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, which is what the process that culminated in forming the World Trade Organization, this stuff was all active. NAFTA was on the table in the U.S. Congress. NAFTA had been approved in Canada, approved in Mexico, and basically we were pushing it through here, and a bunch of us were struggling to stop it. And when I say a bunch, I mean a bunch. There were a few of us in every community who were sitting there scratching our heads trying to figure out what to do. There were some administrations. They were pathetic by today's standards. They were laughable by today's standards. I think I attended one. I can't honestly remember because it was just as small as a whole lot of other little things that I did at the time, and there was really nothing to write home about. What we were trying to do was raise awareness. We were desperate for some way to raise awareness. We couldn't figure it out. We're writing op-ed pieces, and we're trying to do whatever we can to get people in our communities to know that this thing is even happening. These trade agreements used to be fairly secret. It wasn't that it was a conspiracy in the deepest chambers of Congress and you know, the various corporate institutions and whatever in this hemisphere. It was just that it wasn't being talked about in the media very much. And when it was, of course, it was touted. And why the hell not? The media companies and their supporters were going to profit from this type of agreement. And there was no real reason not to be for it. It had the word free in it, so, you know, it's got to be wonderful, right? And that was, this, you know, people realized this. Now, trade unions were the only large contingent that was really organized against us now. There were various interests, environmentalists, and lots of other groups that recognized it as certainly an important factor in their future, in the future of their interest. That didn't culminate into anything big at the time, and it certainly didn't culminate into a general awareness among in the public in the U.S. or really even in Mexico at that time, or really in Canada either. On January 1st, 1994, that culmination actually did take place. That period where all of a sudden something happened where people were going to realize this, and it came about as a result of activism. That activism that I'm referring to, that most of you know, is the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, Mexico, the southernmost state in Mexico, the poorest state in Mexico, one of the poorest places in the hemisphere. The indigenous people there, organizing for a very long time, but organizing explicitly as the Zapatistas for about 10 years, had decided that they were going to choose NAFTA, the first serious major manifestation of this neoliberalism in the form of a free trade agreement in this hemisphere that was going to have massive impact on their future and massive impact on the future of Mexico and the United States and Canada, and they said, we're going to raise hell. That was a very significant event, and one of my biggest frustrations now, organizing in 2001, is that there's a lot of activists who are coming to the anti-globalization movement, the anti-capitalist globalization movement, who don't even understand what happened then. Without the Zapatista uprising, which I played absolutely no role in, and nobody up here did, that was a very autonomous action that came to invigorate support throughout Mexico very rapidly and through certain sectors of radical and left in the United States and Canada was a big boost for us. It was a big morale boost, and not just that, we began to be able to learn lessons about how you organize against globalization. And who better to take those lessons from than the people who did it originally starting 500 years ago in this hemisphere? They've always been the people most impacted, indigenous communities. Now, in a third world country, or in an arguably third world country, if we want to use those terminologies, as Ward Churchill and others have referred to this, the indigenous populations are what are sometimes referred to as the fourth world, super oppressed peoples. They managed to organize not just some demonstrations, but an army. And not just any army, but an army that had answers to the questions that a lot of us had emerged from the 1980s with about Central American and South American and global national liberation movements. They were very inspiring, not only in that they were able to take action when we weren't even able to take action up here, and given their circumstances, there was no particular reason to believe that they were going to be able to stage something as successful as they did and as earth-shaking as they did, but also in that they were doing it very differently. And I'm going to talk, as I go through this talk, about a couple of lessons that our movement has picked up, we've been reminded of at the very least, by the way the Zapatistas organized and the way they continue to organize today. My present involvement revolves around actually doing medical work at these actions, and of course doing some writing here and there and lecturing and that sort of thing. But as an organizer, I'm actually organizing medical support for the demonstrations that are currently growing in North America and throughout the world, actually, though my involvement is in North America only. And I actually think that lends me with, when I'm looking at tactics and strategies that are being implemented on the ground at these demonstrations, actually lends me with a kind of unique perspective that medics have that lots of other people don't. So I'm going to be sharing some of the lessons that I've personally witnessed from some of these things as we go on here. Start doing some criticizing too. I am very, very critical of a lot of the organizing that's going on around anti-capitalist globalization right now. I am also an enormous optimist, and I don't want anybody to leave here, and I hope by the end of this talk I'll have said a few inspiring things to make you realize I'm very hopeful about this movement. But I just don't want people to think that I'm so down on this that, you know, I don't think that it's hopeful. From the beginning, I want you to know that the end of this lecture is going to be that I do think we can make change. I do think we're on to some really amazing things, and that this movement is going to augment lots of other movements, and that those movements are going to eventually be able to augment the anti-globalization movement and form lots of bonds of solidarity around the globe. So what is the movement that we have? And I refer to it as the anti-capitalist globalization movement, even though there's no real official title to this movement. There's no agreed upon term. The reason is because I like that there's sort of a twofold definition of that. We are a movement that is for globalization. At this point, there is not a big trend of people saying we've all got to retract into our little isolationist societies. Among the radical milieu within this movement, the point is not that we are against a globe, that we are against recognizing we have a globe. The idea of that was introduced by colonialism, and it's sort of here to stay. There's no point in pretending that we don't have a globe and that people are going to interact. In a society like the United States, it's absolutely ridiculous to even assume that when we've got this diversity of cultural influences from all over the world. We need to take advantage of that. We need to recognize that and incorporate it. So there's certainly no point in considering anything other than that globalization is the way forward. Especially when we live in a society that is based on having taken from all these other societies. To suggest that what we want to do is halt globalization and stop interaction, economic interaction in particular, between societies, is to say, well, now that we've got everything that you all had to offer, because we've strip mined your land, we've taken all your resources, and we've taken your people, we've enslaved your people, for Christ's sake, now fuck you, what we want to do is just shut it all off. We want no more trade. Well, certainly that's the most ridiculous thing that we can hear of. So we want the word globalization in this. We are anti-capitalist, and what that not only does is points out that we have these radical critiques of the economic system that is dominant in this part of the world especially, but throughout the world and growing, that we have a radical critique of that we're anti-capitalist, that at least the major sector of our movement is also explicitly anti-capitalist, and then the rest of the work that we do that doesn't necessarily have explicit foundation in the globalization issue, that we're also anti-capitalist there. Okay. What also referring to it as anti-capitalist does is it makes it clear that all of the work against capitalism, and whether it's against the certain elements of capitalism or capitalism as a structural entity, radical work against capitalism itself, any work that we do in those realms is against capitalist globalization as well. Where does capitalist globalization get its foundation? Well, in some of the ideological roots are in colonialism, but the basis of it is in the ability of capitalists to expand wealth, to expand control over markets, regardless of the term free market being involved in this. We all know that much. So that's why I like the term itself. When we define our movement, we want to define it in an international manner. I think that that's imperative at this point, and I think it's where we're losing some of the most obvious work when we define our own character. It's very important that we recognize that our movement is not the thing that started since Seattle, or even the thing that started since we realized that NAFTA was going to be this really fucked up thing. What we need to recognize it as is all these people who've been doing work for a long time. There's been work against the IMF and the World Bank since before almost anybody on the left really recognized these institutions as being all that significant, when just sort of economists and labor folks were the only people who even knew these things existed, okay? Africa has been in resistance. India and South Asia have been in resistance. All throughout Latin America, there's been resistance. All throughout Asia, really, there's been resistance to what are now considered neoliberal policies, and certainly resistance to capitalism, et cetera. This movement goes beyond us, and if we recognize that now, we're going to get in, you know, a fairly large, scale-wise, but very limited ghetto. And that's what we're facing. We need to not only be paying attention to some of the voices that are coming over and contributing themselves to our movement from other places in the world, some of the leaders from other countries, but just recognizing that the interconnectedness is going to require us to build more and more ties between our movement here and the other movements that have similar goals, and similar objectives and similar perspectives around the world. Domestically speaking, we want to recognize a plurality of issues. We want to see that the key lesson, I think, from Seattle was the coalition that came about. The fact that groups from what were previously recognized as fairly disparate interests came together around one thing, and that was a benefit. The benefit isn't that we took from that the ability to now just barrel through and oppose globalization from here on out and we're home free. The benefit of that was that we came together and realized, finally, in one of these rare instances, that we do have shared interests and that we need to augment each other's work. So I'm not sure if that's clear, but what I'm really saying is that the benefit isn't to those people, the handful of people who might have started out considering themselves, well, I'm an anti-capitalist globalization activist. Very few people have said that. We come to this from a whole range of issues, and we realize now that there's one issue at least that we can all point to and say, and we all, you know, here we're at ZMI, so we all realize that there's not just a plurality of issues, but there's sort of a holistic context for them, right? That's what we've been talking about for the last week. But here's a concrete example of us actually coming together and working on things, actually needing to interface with one another from different movements. And I think that's one of the biggest benefits of this movement. I don't think that the benefit itself has all that much to do with globalization or our ability to oppose it. So when we start understanding a global context, we start looking at one thing in particular, and here's a very explicit lesson from the Zapatistas that's really important to understand. When we look at that interface that I'm talking about between our movement here, or whatever, our part of the movement in the United States and Canada and North America, and similar components, similar elements, complementary movements in the rest of the world, the term is solidarity, and it's a term that's been around for a while and it's here to stay, and that the Zapatistas sort of helped us redefine, and we're finally learning the lessons about this. Throughout the 1980s and before, solidarity almost always meant, when we're talking about colonialism, we're talking about U.S. imperialism in these countries, solidarity almost always meant that we send stuff to these other countries that are in need. We're trying to offset the horrible things that our military and our economic system are doing by tilting these other countries in one direction. And we say, well, we're going to send people to be protective accompaniment. We're going to send lots of toilet paper and medical supplies and other things like that, because we do have a privileged society. We do have excess, and we can acquire some of these things and send them down. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, at all. But what the Zapatistas decided to say was, you know, it's great. That's really cool. We want all that stuff. That's fine. Keep sending the toilet paper. Keep sending the diapers. Keep sending the medical supplies. Keep sending yourselves to come. But when you come, learn. And there's one thing that's important, is that solidarity cannot be unilateral, that we have to be taking things back. If we're going down there, then it has to be to learn. We have to realize that there are a lot of people in this world who, whatever color their skin or whatever position they are, socioeconomic position in life, they have a lot to teach us, something that we're just figuring out. And that solidarity for the Zapatistas meant, first and foremost, that we're kicking ass here at home. They said, we can hold these folks off for a little while longer, but if you can remove the boot from our neck by stopping your society from being able to even have the ability to accommodate funding our government that's doing it directly to us, then boy, would that be a big relief. So if you could please go home, after you have your visit and you learn some things and maybe contribute here and there, we say you should. The respectful folks who went down, who've been going down and been doing exactly that, contribute where they're asked to and shut up the rest of the time. Then please go home and organize people against all the shit that's going on in your society. And not just imperialism, and not just the massive military expenditures that are going to support the war in Mexico, But against the shit that you guys need to recognize is your own problem. Please stop letting us distract you from the fact that your cities have third worlds in them, that racism and sexism and all the other things that we're beginning to really get a grip on down here are very much rampant at home. Go home and take care of that shit, and if you can do that, it isn't the idea of bringing a front to the, you know, home or anything like that and start a war there so that they forget that there's a war down here. The idea is that by building infrastructure here, and the infrastructure that isn't focused on sending things down south, but infrastructure that's focused on building an actual movement here, well, only then are we really going to be able to contribute to this sort of rescue attempt that we've all been so desperate to be engaged in with regard to the rest of the world, with regard to the global south especially. So simply what we're doing is we're beginning to realize that, okay, the U.S. is probably not the best vanguard for the rest of the world. Whether it's the radicals here or the capitalists here, maybe we shouldn't be the ones who are doing the leading. Maybe we should be doing a lot of work, and maybe we should be taking advantage of certain privileges that a lot of us have here in order to do that work. But maybe we should be taking ideas from other people around the world and taking inspiration from them. So I still go around and I still spend a lot of time talking about the Zapatistas because I don't know of any other group in the world right now that is quite as inspiring as them. There's certainly other smaller movements in various places. There's even groups in North America that do some awesome work. But when it comes down to just flat out looking at somebody and saying, you know, those people have their shit together, whether they're doing things exactly right or exactly the way we would, they've got something to look at and learn from, and it's an important lesson for us. The next topic I want to think about is the movement demographics. Who is making up this anti-capitalist globalization movement? We hear a big complaint, and I think it's a very legitimate complaint, and that is that our movement is not diverse. Why aren't people of color, why aren't more poor people coming to join our movement? Well, boo fucking who, it's because we aren't doing a very good job of making that movement palatable to them. Not only that, but that is the perspective that we're taking, is that we need to make our movement palatable to those people. Why aren't we, I ask everybody that I work with, working more on issues that affect those people? Why don't they prioritize anti-capitalist globalization as the pinnacle of their liberation? Well, it's quite simply because there are lots of people in this society who really do have bigger problems in the immediate. And so again, the organization and the infrastructure building that those communities are doing, and I'm saying, and I'm using those and them in this case because look at me, I'm a white boy, okay, and I'm fairly privileged. So. And I don't mean to exclude anybody or do too much generalizing here. I'm just kind of using some shorthand. The communities are doing a lot of work around issues that explicitly affect them much more directly than at least they perceive anti-globalization issue, the capitalist globalization issue, and I think probably in reality that issue affects them. Those groups are indeed building a movement against capitalist globalization. If they are fighting capitalism or they are fighting elements of capitalist effect on them, then certainly aren't they building part of the infrastructure that we need to be involved in this. So it's not crying about that not everybody is doing exactly what we're doing when we're out there in the streets of Quebec or we're out there in the streets of Seattle. What we need to realize is that we have to define this movement a little bit more broadly, and it isn't just the folks who show up there. When it comes to the folks who show up there, I do think that's still relevant. I'm not saying that it's really wonderful that we've got these almost exclusively white demonstrations that are pretty exciting and pretty inspiring to those white people who show up and to the white people watching on TV, etc. We actually need to recognize is that there are some barriers there, and that there's a few things that we can do to sort of get around them to make things more accessible. One of the barriers is that, well, we keep having these things in very localized situations. They pick a summit, the capitalists pick a summit to happen, and then we say everybody's got to go to the summit and protest. What's starting to happen, which is really refreshing, is that communities are realizing that, A, the base of support against globalization has grown to the point where we can have local demonstrations. Okay, and B, these things are getting kind of old. These summit things, they're starting to wear thin, and what we really need to do and what we really can do now, because we have sort of a foundation, a popular foundation for it, is start organizing locally. What we're seeing is that there are sort of sister demonstrations, if you will, going on in lots of cities around North America and around the world when these major summits are happening. That's good. We need to be supporting that. One of the ways we can be supporting it is by acknowledging that it happens, and in our media, especially, you know, in the alternative media, we need to be focusing a lot on that. Also, in sharing our organizing lessons. Well, those are much more difficult demonstrations to pull off at this point. They really are. How do you get people to come to this thing if you don't have this summit, you don't have this promise that the Black Bloc is going to show up, or lots of other things? We have to be learning lessons on how these folks who are doing this successfully are actually getting people to show up and are actually getting people inspired. Speaking of the Black Bloc, now there we've got another interesting thing that's kind of presenting a diversification culturally, racially, and class-wise of our movement. The tactics that are being used, and it's certainly, I'm certainly not just want to pick on the Black Bloc here, but high-risk tactics that are being used right now in on the streets at these things are very, very off-putting to a lot of people. Those people in particular are the ones who are going to be, first of all, targeted more by the police, second of all, treated worse inside the system. People of color know that this is going to be the case for them. There's no point in arguing it. There's no point in saying, well, we'll take care of you if you get arrested or any of that shit. It's not going to work. It's not true, and they know it. And we need to start realizing that actually this is very exclusive. If we're going to keep escalating tactics, we're going to keep turning people off to them. The people that we're going to be turning off are the people that we all the rest of the time are crying about not having there. We've got to start paying attention to that. It doesn't mean that we eliminate those tactics completely. And it also doesn't mean that those tactics don't, in some cases, inspire lots of underprivileged folks to say, damn, it's really cool that these white privileged kids are out there, you know, kicking a little bit of ass and being willing to get their asses kicked. There's something to that. I was in Cincinnati for the Transatlantic Business Dialogue protests there. Fairly small protests. And being organized out of a primarily black community there called the Over the Rhine community, a neighborhood in Cincinnati where impoverishment is just an extreme. It's where the riots in Cincinnati last spring began and are going to continue to go on. It's where lots of resistance to police brutality is going on. And we had a lot of chance to interact with folks, and they were saying, well, what are you guys here for? Well, I didn't realize how hard it was going to be to answer that question until an African-American guy just kind of wandered up and said, hey, what are you guys doing here? And I said, we're organizing against the Transatlantic Business Dialogue. All right, how the hell do I explain that? Well, to be honest with you, this day, I really don't fully understand the TABD, as I'll start abbreviating it, But I did start to explain globalization and various things like that. And he said, yeah, I know what that is. He actually understood, you know, he understood. Well, big surprise there. I didn't know what TABD was, and neither did he, but we both knew what free trade was, and we both knew what globalization were. And he and lots of other people that we're meeting in that community were very, very supportive of us. We were doing, the medics were actually doing a little bit of work in the community there around healthcare and stuff like that, because we figured, hey, if we're coming to town, we might as well offer a few services here, see what's up, hang out with people, talk to people. There was a lot of respect and appreciation for all these white kids who were pouring into town to take on these issues. Part of the reason was is that the same white kids were willing to take on the police brutality issue, which was extremely hot there, just like it is this spring and just like it's going to be all summer. But another part of the reason was simply that they did recognize that this was an important issue. What we couldn't do was convince them to come out to the demonstrations. We tried. I admit, I tried real hard. I said, hey, we're going to have these great marches, and I wasn't convinced that they were going to be great, but I figure, what the hell, give it a shot, right? I wasn't convinced that I was going to be interested, and I was pretty certain there was a good chance that people of color and diverse communities weren't going to be interested, that they're not going to be thrilled about puppets and you know, quiet chanting and things like that. I'd had indications in that direction before. People wouldn't come out, and the reason was, well, on the one hand, I think it's really cool that you guys are out there confronting the police and trying to get through the police and raise your issues. I'm afraid, and that was it. That was what it boiled down to. You know, we'll watch, but we do not want to be mistaken for you. If you're going to be out there and you're going to do anything from yell at the police to throw something at the police, I want to be as far away as possible. That made me sad because I knew there was absolutely nothing I could do about the fact that certain people were actually going to do that, that they were going to increase the violence that was brought upon us, just like at every single other one of these demonstrations that I've been to, ranging from about Cincinnati level to Quebec level, was horrendous. A lot of people were hurt, a lot of people suffered, a lot of people were arrested, and a lot of people were tortured and abused in jail. That sucks for us, privileged people, white people, who this happens. It's going to suck more for people of color who have fewer resources, more to lose, and who against the bias of the system is going to be brought on full level. Okay, these are a lot of the things that we, I think, are beginning to realize, aren't doing too much about, and in some ways are having our efforts thwarted about too by certain who insist on escalating when maybe what we should be doing is looking at ways to actually have demonstrations that are more inviting. Here's where another lesson that the Zapatistas have been teaching us, I think, is important, is going to come in too. One of the things that the Zapatistas insist on is that they've developed a culture of resistance. That the reason the Zapatista army could form was that there was a resistance culture there. That democracy among the Mayan people has been translated into resistance democracy. Democracy in opposition to the bullshit of the bigger system. They recognize that and they live by it. And it's part of their culture. That's something that we will have to manufacture, that we will have to kind of fudge here. There are certainly resistance cultures within the U.S. And here, indigenous cultures are in some cases the best examples. In lots of other quote-unquote minority cultures, people of color and ethnicities, that can contribute a lot to resistance. But we've lost a lot of that. And I think Michael Albert did a really good job of expressing how the 60s movement was much more culturally driven than ours is today. Some really good examples of culture in our movement, but the idea is that we need cultures that are informed by lots of other cultures. And here I'm going to pick on the puppet thing again. Because I've heard so many people of color say either, and poor people too, say, why do you keep making puppets of black people that are carried by white people? Well, that's a really, really valid criticism. Why are we doing that? Why aren't we inviting people of color to come and lead us in cultural expression and actually introduce some things to some of the white folks who've been dominant in organizing here? These are some important things that we need to address. Developing that culture of resistance in our own way, and I'm not saying adopting and incorporating lots of other cultures and saying, well, now look at how diverse we are, but coming to something, and puppets are part of that. Puppets are absolutely a good element of that. If that's what's getting people excited, which I keep hearing, then that's fine. But there's a lot more elements that need to be introduced as well. Objectives and strategy. I don't have too much time to talk at this point, but and there's too many objectives and too many types of strategy to discuss to get into too much detail. But I do think that one of the main objectives, we just need to highlight and sort of admit sometimes expose for ourselves what some of our strategies and our objectives are going to be. One of our objectives at this point and for a long time in the future needs to be exposure. When we look at the history of the anti-capitalist globalization movement, let's just say, you know, over the last decade, exposure has been a major component in growing the movement. Without that, we don't know what's going on. It's also been a good component in working against some of the agreements and some of the bullshit that they've been trying to pass at us. So the Zapatista uprising was a major form of exposure. It didn't stop NAFTA. It came after NAFTA had been passed, but it did actually give a big boost to our movement, like I talked about before. In Canada, when the multilateral agreement on investments came around, lots and lots of Canadian organizers said, hey, we're gonna recognize this, and the strategy then is going to be all we need to do is show people, and this is an agreement that was very secret compared to a lot of the other ones that have been coming around, all we need to do is tell the public that this is happening, and those who are negotiating it will be stalled. Because the imperative there was that these things happen in secret. We no longer have that advantage because now they're working around ways to actually negotiate these things in secret. But the MAI was a pretty severe agreement that was mostly run by corporations. There wasn't a lot of public involvement, if really any, it was negligible. And what the Canadians had to do, really what anyone in the world had to do, and it certainly did take forms in other countries, but Canada was where the sort of vanguard of that little portion of it was. All they had to do was expose it, and they did that. They did that through massive demonstrations, and they did that through consciousness raising, and they did that through a lot of actual groundwork and community level organizing. with exposure, we're going to continue to have these big demonstrations. We're going to continue to point out what's going on. People are going to learn things like that there's something called the International Monetary Fund, that there's something called the World Bank, that there's something called the World Trade Organization, even that there's something called the Transatlantic Business Dialogue. We're going to start exposing these things. What we're also going to do, I hope, and what I'm beginning to see but not quite enough of, is that when we get home from the big summits, when we get home from the big climactic events, we're going to be working in our communities. We're not only going to be working around informing people about globalization, but we're going to be working on these other issues that I'm insisting are part of the anti-capitalist globalization movement, whether they're explicit about it or not. So exposure is one of the major goals we have at this point. Another goal that we have to continue to have is an increase in inclusiveness and participation. I've already reflected on a lot of those things, but we need to make it an explicit objective. Not all of our objectives are external. Not everything is what effect can our movement have on the outside world. Some of it is what do we need to accomplish within our movement explicitly. Let's get it out there and say it in order to be able to grow and in order, in turn, to be able to have that effect on things outside of our movement. And one of the main components of that in an explicit objective, again, is also going to be coalition building that's going on, drawing the connections between the various issues and various interest groups and various organizations and movements that are already in place, and that's going to be another major component in an explicit goal. Let's say that one of the big things about Seattle and one of the big things about every future demonstration that we can do this at that's going to be most important is that we're drawing those coalitions. Let's get out there and say it. Not necessarily what the effect that has on globalization, again, but what it means to our movement. I do want to talk a little bit about tactics in the streets, what's going on in the streets. I also would expect that that's probably going to be a source of the question and answer period too. So I just want to say some of the observations that I've had. The visible presence is and will be for a long time the most important thing that's going on at demonstrations. The size of that presence and the creativity of that presence and the vocality of that presence, these are all factors in it, but they're the most important thing. Let's not make a mistake about it. People are going to always be, at this point, most impressed with the least controversy about just the people that show up and express themselves in creative ways and in massive numbers. Let's keep that being the focus. That's my proposal. When it comes to the more intense stuff, when it comes to what we consider as we need to start really raising very more direct costs, more explicit costs to these oppressors, one of the neat things that's happening is that we've demonstrated as a movement, as an accomplishment of ours, that if you want to meet and talk about these things, you're going to have to either do it behind police barricades, behind small armies that you formed yourselves, and all the delegates are going to have to bring their own henchmen, which they're literally now doing. They're all bringing people who have special permits, like even in places like Canada, to carry pistols in order to protect the delegates. We're going to make them paranoid. We're going to make them realize that, yeah, if you want to do this, we're going to show up, and you kind of do have to do it in secret. Or, you know, you'll have to move to Qatar, you'll have to move to a country that none of you even want to go to, that none of you have considered taking a vacation to, and that's where you're going to have to go. And instead of going to beautiful Quebec, you have to go to Qatar. Because in Qatar, of course, there's going to be a fair guarantee that there aren't going to be any main protests, because anyone who does it stands a high likelihood of being killed. But that's what they're resorted to. And that exposes, it kind of hides things, too. It puts them off that in Qatar, we don't have access to exposing them. So there's a downside to a lot of these upsides, but what it does do is show that they realize that we're able to mobilize. What we're doing with that mobilizing isn't really impressing them that much. The ability to shut them down and to blockade them, you know, that was most successful in Seattle and really hasn't had much of an effect since, except a short delay in D.C. at the A16 and then a short delay in Quebec. This isn't how we're going to stop it. And Michael talked about it yesterday. They're going to find a place to meet, okay? That's all there is to it. Unless we can really get in there and abduct the delegates and ensure that they don't get replaced, we really don't stand any chance of preventing them from continuing to meet. So let's not make that a major objective. Let's recognize that sometimes it's fun and sometimes it has, you know, movement-building capacity, but that's the limit of it. It's not going to stop globalization. They have these internet things with the video and whatnot. If they need to, they can do it from home. And let's face it, you know, going to hang out at these places is nice, but really what they're there for is to plan the demise of the world, and that's gonna continue, whether they get to be on vacation while they're doing it or not. I'm going to throw out a quickie here. We've got to stop having the long marches. They're killing the medics, okay? I'm carrying like 30 pounds of gear, all right? I'm carrying other people's waters because they forget it. Let's just stop with the long marches unless we can keep them exciting. So let's also stop with the boring rallies and the boring marches. Enough said. You can. Another thing I'm not too sure in this movement is having much of a positive effect is the intentional arrest thing, or the symbolic arrest thing. On April 17th, 2000, in D.C., there was a negotiation between police and some people who thought they represented the people, you know, the folks there, the demonstrators. A negotiation was made that we will cross the line and you will arrest us as we pretend to walk toward the IMF building to pretend to give our voices or whatever. We won't bring signs, I think, and we won't say anything on our way, and you can nicely arrest us. Now, that was done to add to the numbers. And one reason that was done, that it's legit in that case, it was done to add to the numbers of people in jail, to clog the system, to ensure that there could be really good jail solidarity, and that people would be able to get out with, you know, close to nothing or nothing as a charge. And that was effective. I'm not sure if that particular part of the demonstration was needed, because there were already like 900 people in jail or something, but it was effective in that effect. What it also did was make a whole bunch of people, and again, including underprivileged folks, including people of color, who looked at that and said, that's absolutely insane. I don't want to be a part of a movement where that's what we do. And to a lot of us who had been kind of really active and loud out there, we said, you know, I don't want to negotiate my own capitulation, which is how we saw it. I think we need to really evaluate the effect that has on morale, because it was a rainy day and a whole lot of people, I think thousands and thousands of people, left that area going, damn, that was the most depressing climax I've ever seen. If we hadn't shown up today, I'd feel a lot better, because yesterday was a hell of a lot better day. Let's try to keep the days getting better than the day before. Let's try to pay attention to those sorts of things when we're doing our strategizing. There's a lot of other things I wanted to talk about. I think there's some neat elements to the Spokes Council things that are going on, and some ways that we can incorporate a little bit more of an inclusive factor in them, and also pay attention to what are actual real security needs at this point. For those groups that are going to be doing stuff that requires secrecy and security, they need to start organizing the Spokes Council things a little bit better. We're seeing lots of infiltration, we're seeing lots of arrests and stuff that are absolutely unnecessary as a result of the police being able to just wander in wearing a Mumia t-shirt and listen in and find out what people are doing. Or worse, being able to join an affinity group because wearing a Mumia t-shirt. This isn't where the idea of affinity group came from. It wasn't that you have a group. It was that you have affinity and that there's lots of different ways to organize. I have some opinions on this, but I also want to keep in mind a very important element in this. To the extent that secret organizing and direct action and a lot of radical tactics are beneficial and necessary, let's organize those more carefully. Let's also pay attention to how damn exclusive that stuff is. Okay, so there's a balance there, and we've got to find it. I am never going to ask people not to do direct action. I've done it a lot in my past. It's been one of the most inspiring elements of my participation as an activist. And eventually, we're going to need to practice for having done it, because I think that there's going to be a much bigger role for it in the future. So I like that we're doing it now, but I do want to make sure that we're careful and that this whole diversity of tactics things that really is being insisted on mostly by people who want to destroy property and who might have inclination for violence, that the diversity is actually respected in both angles. And I'd be more than happy to talk a little bit more about the violence thing and stuff like that if you want to ask. I want to close up my part of my blabbing part here by discussing just a few little things that, after all this criticism, I want people to realize there's a reason that I'm animated right now. There's a reason that I'm still in this movement, that I'm going to be in this anti-capitalist globalization movement, the explicit part of it and the not-so-explicit part of it, for a long time to come. And most of them have to do, like I said before, Zapatismo and the EZLN uprising was a major part of my inspiration for a long time, and then Seattle was too, and my current participation is, because what I'm doing as a street medic is, to me, and this is just a perspective that I want to share, whether it means anything or not to you guys, I hope it does. What I get to do is I get to meet people who are sometimes in their most vulnerable moment that came immediately after their strongest moment that so far happened in their life. I met a kid named Rob on April 17th in D.C. last year who had decided, for some reason, I'm not quite sure, he'd seen a police car coming to escort a van that actually didn't contain anybody, but people suspected contained some delegates, trying to leave one of the meetings. And he decided he was going to go lay down in front of the police car. Well, I'm not even going to talk about the tactics of that, the soundness of that. We all end up getting tear gassed. A whole shitload of people got beaten who didn't even know that he had done this. But this man decided, regardless of his understanding of the context he was in, that he was going to go and lie down in front of a police car. Then what happened was he got dragged by police, and a cop emptied a can of pepper spray about this big in front of his face. And I recently saw a video of that, which I'd never seen because I didn't see Rob get injured. Rob got dragged. He had welts. By the time I found him 20 minutes after his injuries were incurred, he had welts all the way up his back, and his face was, to this day, I haven't seen somebody who's quite so damaged by chemical weapons. He could not open his eyes, and it took us 20 minutes. And it was fairly practiced medics by this point, having been flushing people's eyes for 2 days. He could barely open his eyes. He was crying. I think he was crying. I don't know if it was just the tearing effect of the gas or that he was actually sad or whatever, but he was in pretty bad shape. He looked like shit. Taking one look at him almost scared me into peeing, okay? I talked with Rob and tried to increase his morale the whole time that we were having this discussion, and I asked him, you know, what's going on with you? What are you here for? How you been? We do that. We try to make conversation. Rob was really new. This was his first major demonstration. He didn't know what commitment was until he laid down in front of that car, and he sort of explained it to me. Meanwhile, a couple other people who brought him over to us, to the medics, were explaining to us, holy shit, this guy got really taken out. You know, like, he did something really courageous. I started to get this feeling like, you know, I'm a little bit upset that I now am treating the person who I have to blame for all the other people that I just treated who didn't even know they were going to get injured. Some elements of what he did were kind of stupid. But what happened was, when I got Rob's eyes flushed, and I'm talking 20 minutes of constant work, we're working on his back that's all torn up, as soon as I saw his eyes, and I swear they were the most beautiful eyes I've ever seen, he said, when can I get back out there? These are the people that we have making up this movement, okay? Rob was a bit of an exception because he was crazy enough to jump in front of that car, but he wasn't an exception as far as I have witnessed with my patients who've been injured, and that's the question that people have. When can I begin contributing again? Sometimes I have to tell them, look, you're done for the day. You might be done for the week, depending on the injuries. But it's really hard to convince even people with severe injuries of that. There was a young woman in Boston at the debate protests who had also been, you know, kind of dabbling in the anti-globalization stuff and was really inspired by this movement. And she got some really bad pepper spray. She had never even understood that police would hurt white people. She really didn't get it. She didn't expect that it was going to happen to her. And she made a transformative process there while she was being treated, while we were sort of talking to her, and she kind of explained that she made this realization. She went from being really scared to being really empowered and treated a kid in Quebec who was beaten pretty severely over the head by a club. He'd had his earring torn out, and he looked like an absolute disaster. His injuries were pretty severe. His name was Spinach. That was the name he gave me. He was wearing the black sweatshirt, and he was a black blocker. And something that I realized about him as I was joking with him about how his dreadlocks may very well have saved his life because they had prevented the gash that the cops put in his head from spreading beyond a couple of really thick dreadlocks that he had there. He was explaining to me, you know, why he was there, and he's telling me a lot of really inspiring things that I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that he was doing, and I kind of think, hey, you know, some of these people are getting a lot of other people that I spend my time treating hurt. However, when I realized that he had 4 plastic bullet wounds from the day before on his legs, and that he had gone out and got beaten again, it doesn't tell me a lot about his ability to think clearly, okay? It really doesn't. But again, it's just another instance of, you know, I look at these folks and the risks that people are taking at this point. The resource is there. The energy is there. Young people are absolutely invigorated. We're becoming militant. And as soon as we can really get a grip on ourselves and say, how do we direct this, there's just no stopping it. There's absolutely no stopping it. If we're putting this kind of energy and this kind of dedication, willingness to take risks, in the right direction, if that risk translates to the risk of feeling humiliated when I go and organize in my community among people that might laugh at me, that might not answer the door the first 10 times, if I can really, you know, translate the courage that I take into the streets as I go out there as a medic and, you know, okay, here comes the tear gas, everybody's running this way and I'm running that way, yada, yada. If I can really harness that at home and do some community organizing and do some outreach that really counts, then we've got a revolution on our hands, and that's quite simply the truth. That's what we need to do right now. So thanks a lot.